From KCBW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Bob Farrington moved to Salt Lake City in 1992, and one of the first things he did as the new director of the Downtown Alliance was launch a farmer's market. It started out small, just four or five growers offering their wares on summer Saturdays in Pioneer Park. But the idea of the market struck a chord with urban consumers hungry for local produce, fresh fruits, and organic goods. 20 years later, the market has become one of the largest in the West, drawing 250 vendors and 10,000 consumers each week. Today on the program, we celebrate two decades of the Downtown Farmers Market with Bob Farrington, a couple of farmers, and your memories. Plus, art meets engineering. We hear about a new exhibit at the Utah Museum of Fine Art. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. 20 years ago, the Downtown Farmers Market launched a commitment to organic and locally grown foods in Salt Lake City with just a handful of local growers. And today, more than 250 vendors pack Pioneer Park every Saturday morning through the growing season. Today on the program, we're celebrating the market's 20th anniversary with a look at the market's humble beginnings and its role in broadening the local message. Joining me in studio is Bob Farrington. He is the Salt Lake City Economic Development Director. He's the former director of the Downtown Alliance, and in that capacity, he founded the Downtown Farmers Market 20 years ago. And Bob Farrington, welcome. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Also with us, John Borski, a local organic farmer who owns Borski Organic Farms in Kaysville. He's been vending at the farmers market for the past 17 years. John Borski joins me in studio as well. John, good morning.
Hi, Jennifer.
Also with us, Mele Tuione is the owner of Malolo Gardens, an organic family farm with a new storefront across from Pioneer Park. She will be vending at this year's farmers market for the first time, and she joins me in studio as well. Mele, good morning.
Good morning, Jennifer.
The Downtown Farmers Market, of course, will open this Saturday, June 9th, in Pioneer Park, 300 West, 400 South. It will be open Saturday mornings through October. Later on in the program, art and the need for speed. We're going to hear more about a new exhibit at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts. But first, the Downtown Farmers Market. What keeps you going to Pioneer Park on Saturday mornings? How has the farmers market changed your eating habits, your buying habits, or encouraged you to start a garden of your own? Join us at 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. John Borski, I want to start with you. You've brought some produce into the studio. What have you got growing so far this year?
Hey, we've got a few fresh radishes, and the peas are looking good this year. We've had a nice spring, and some of the early crops are doing really well.
Okay, Mele, and your first attempt at gardening, how's it going so far?
It's going good. We've also got a few things coming on. We've got some radishes and some broccoli, and a lot of the greenhouse cucumbers and peppers are coming on as well.
Okay, so the heat hasn't wilted those greens yet?
No, not yet.
Okay. Bob Farrington, you moved to Salt Lake City in 1992 to lead the Downtown Alliance. So where did this idea to start a farmer's market downtown come from?
Well, it came from a number of people in the community who all, I think, shared a bit of a common vision that we had this great tradition in Utah of growing wonderful crops and had fruits throughout the valley and the region. But the way that they were, consumed and accessed by the public was perhaps not the most contemporary and vibrant setting. And so it was a combination of people who understood, like John, the kind of the growing dimension of farming, but other people who saw what a farmer's market could do to change the social dynamics and bring a sense of community to the public and also transform a neighborhood in Salt Lake City.
Okay, so you and others sort of hatched this idea. How was the idea received by city leadership? Didi Corradini was mayor at the time.
Yeah, I think the community was incredibly supportive from the get-go. Everyone, I think, loved the concept and the idea. There's always a lot of challenges to bring an idea to fruition and work out all the mechanics and logistics. But it was one that I thought from the very beginning really had the makings of becoming very popular, sustainable, and as it is today, kind of a community institution.
How did you settle on Pioneer Park? Now, you know, it's a part of town that's had its share of crime. It's kind of known as a drug dealing area, known for as a refuge for the city's homeless. Why put the farmers market there?
Well, it was certainly a controversial and highly debated location. But one of the purposes of the farmers market, besides trying to acknowledge and support our local growers, was to, in creating a gathering place, was to transform a neighborhood. And that was one that certainly needed some help. And it's a little bit hard to imagine if people haven't been around Salt Lake for very long, for 20 years, what that landscape looked like 20 years ago.
Take us back. Tell us what it was like.
Well, there it was a beautiful space, you know, mature trees, shady. Certainly the atmospherics of the park lent itself to something like a farmer's market. We had looked at the Boulder Market, and they had a somewhat analogous situation in their park. But the neighborhood surrounding it was a bit of a war zone, didn't have the Marriott, the Residence Inn, didn't have the apartments nearby. The Greek Church was probably the only going concern in the neighborhood. And so we were hoping that a different way of reintroducing people to the assets of Pioneer Park as this great historic park might eventually lead to some changes in the neighborhood. And lo and behold, 20 years later, I think it's been played out as well as we, I think, could have expected. But it took a lot of convincing. And one of the, you know, subtle things we tried to do throughout the farmers market is to acknowledge the history of Pioneer Park and use that as an asset, because it is a beautiful place, and we recaptured it for a day, and hopefully that transition is happening throughout the week.
It is called Pioneer Park because that's one of the first areas that pioneers settled here in the valley.
Yeah, and there was a lot of ownership in the community to try to enhance it and make it better, and that helped support the market. So I think at every turn there was a interesting confluence of interest from historic preservationists, neighborhood activists, the city, many others who wanted to support the market, but they also wanted to support a transformation of the park and the neighborhood. Mm.
Speaking with Bob Farrington, Salt Lake City's Economic Development Director, he is also the former director of the Downtown Alliance and helped launch the Downtown Farmers Market, which is celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. Also in studio, Mele Tueone is the owner of Malolo Gardens, an organic family farm, which will be showing vending at Pioneer Park during the farmers market for the first time starting this Saturday, and John Borski, who's been part of the farmers market downtown for the past 17 years. And if you'd like to join us with your questions or comments or memories of the downtown farmers market, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Pioneer Park, a bit of a tough sell in the beginning. John Borski, you've been a vendor at the farmers market for the past 17 years. What convinced you that this was something you wanted to be a part of, and why did you decide to jump in and stay there for so many years?
I'd been to a couple of farmers markets in a couple other parts of the country as I was traveling around as a professional dancer, and I'd always been interested in gardening. My grandmother had some beautiful land here in Utah, and I remember working in her garden with her and eating the fresh raspberries and eating the fresh vegetables and enjoying it so much that when I had a chance to live in New York City for a while, I didn't realize how uncommon something like that was. And as I was getting older, I mentioned I visited a farmer's market in Boulder and one in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and it just seemed like the hippest thing going, and the people there were real conscious about what they were eating. They were getting excited about it. They were getting excited about better food, and I think that's really kind of what motivated me. As a dancer, you had to eat well to stay fit and stay in shape, and as a farmer, if you're growing locally especially, you're growing what everyone should eat, and luckily I'm able to do that and, of course, reap the benefits myself.
Borski Farms, of course, based in Kaysville. You grow vegetables, herbs, fruit. Describe the first time that you opened in the downtown farmers market. What was that like?
Oh, my gosh. I remember maybe six or seven vendors there. I remember the young lady that was there. They were having a contest to see if every vendor could get there for every market, just, you know, trying to encourage more of the farmers to get there with more produce and stay throughout the season. When I was at the first market, I remember pulling up in an old truck that I had, and I came around that first corner, and my table slid off the truck and went sliding and slammed into the ditch, and people ran over and grabbed it, and they come over and helped me put it back in the truck, and I went over and got set up. Not only that, people were so anxious that were there early, they would kind of help us get set up and get going, and it would just be hand over fist vegetables for about 2 or 3 hours. And I don't think I ever lasted past 10 or 11 o'clock. And we'd be sold out. And we'd actually be out of there pretty early, so at the early market.
So you had an immediate customer base right there.
Almost unbelievable. It was something, it was an energy and something that it seemed like people really wanted, but they just weren't getting it.
And one of the challenges in a way too is to find other people like John, because there wasn't quite the network and the sort of the local food community that we have today. I mean, it was really in its very much nascent form, and I remember, you know, driving throughout the valley and throughout the state just grabbing anybody who I would come across that had a big garden or was selling something at a roadside stand or in front of their house to, you know, give them some literature, educate them about the farmers market as another opportunity to grow, because we really couldn't tap into the people like John. They were a little bit hidden, and eventually now they're overwhelmed with applicants. Never enough farmers. That was always the trick too.
Well, some of the old farmers, I remember when I first started, and I was like, yeah, there's this market down in Salt Lake, and I'm not kidding you, there's 1,000 people or more showing up there on weekends, and really not enough creative produce. And some of the old farmers really weren't, oh, you know, we're satisfied here on our farm, taking care of things. I'm not crazy about driving to Salt Lake. There are a few of them now that rush there on Saturday morning and go back and get a second load with more, and they're there till 12 and 1 o'clock. They sell a lot of produce.
So what was that turning point, Bob? I mean, from the humble beginnings, you reaching out almost as like a traveling salesman, trying to get people to come to downtown. And now we see you have to turn people away. I mean, it's so crowded and it's vibrant and well established.
One thing, you know, just kind of built on the success of the next. And as John indicated, the public certainly had a hankering for it, because, you know, heretofore, the only way to access the kind of beautiful product, and I'm looking at John's produce here, it's just works of art here. It's, at a roadside stand that maybe wasn't convenient to where people lived, or the Farm Bureau ran a place next to the freeway, which wasn't the most inviting location to have a market. But one of the things I think that really helped was that the Downtown Alliance, as an organization that had some funding, we were able to market both to farmers and to the public what was happening. And there was this somewhat relentless marketing machine that was able to communicate that Pioneer Park was safe, it was a good location, it was a fun, hip thing that was going on. And a lot of smaller community markets, which are great things that are springing up throughout the state, don't maybe have that backing and wherewithal, so they can only do so much with limited resources. So we had a little bit more that we were able to deploy, and I think that was a difference maker too.
Mele Tua One, I understand this is your first season selling at Pioneer Park. You're new to the farming thing altogether. Why join the downtown farmers market now?
The downtown farmers market was really the farmers market that I wanted to get. I applied to several, and we're jumping into this full force, and we've got a good size of land, and we've grown all of our starts from seed. And while we applied to many, this was absolutely the one.
Why?
Because of the size of it, because of the reputation, because of everything that goes into. You know, you say downtown farmers market, you get masses of people there. You get visions of it's just all of the good stuff that a farmers market has to offer, all of the artisans, all of the vendors.
And you're also opening a brick-and-mortar shop just across the street from Pioneer Park. I guess you're hoping that the farmer's market magic will sustain you the growing season.
We are hoping for that. We picked this spot specifically because of the downtown farmer's market right across the street, hoping to catch on to the magic from that, absolutely.
We are talking about the Downtown Farmers Market, which opens this Saturday, June 9th, in Pioneer Park in Salt Lake City. And it'll be open Saturday mornings through October. If you'd like to join us with your favorite memories of the 20 years the Downtown Farmers Market has been in existence in Salt Lake, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. What began as a few local growers gathering once a week into Pioneer Park has blossomed into one of the largest local markets in the West. The Downtown Farmers Market is celebrating 20 years, and today on the program, we're talking with one of the founders of the market, Bob Farrington, also John Borski with Borski Organic Farms, who's been selling produce at the market for about 17 years, and a new vendor, Mele Tuaone, is with Malolo Farms, and you can join us as well. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. If you've got a favorite memory of the market or a reason why you keep going back, give us a call. Let's go to the phones. Gina is joining us from Salt Lake City. Gina, hi.
Hi, how are you this morning?
Good, thanks.
Good. I work at Utahns Against Hunger, and I was just calling in to thank the Downtown Farmers Market for accepting food stamp benefits. It's a really great way for low-income folks to have access to fresh, affordable local food, and you know, it's a program that grows every year, and we're really excited to be part of that.
Okay, Gina, thanks very much for the call. And Bob Farrington, a new development, wanting to empower everyone in the community, whether or not you have means or not, to be able to get healthy and locally produced foods.
Yeah, that's always been, I think, part of the ethos of the market, especially because of the location, to try to assist people who are less fortunate. So I know the individual farmers do that at the end of the day with people who might come around and give their produce away. I remember many years ago we created our own version of the WIC program, locally based, where we could bring coupons to people, women, infant children, to help them introduce them to fresh foods and better eating, and then more recently the EBT program that helps people as well. So I think the market's always been open to those kind of needs in the community and how to help.
Gina Cornea from Utahns Against Hunger, thanks so much for your call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Let's go to Sharon in Salt Lake City. Sharon, hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good, thank you. Go right ahead.
I just wanted to comment and call. I grew up doing farmer's market. We were one of the first farmers in Pope Davis Farms that came to farmer's market, Pioneer Park. We used to go to the one that was on 53rd. And I remember just going there and basically grew up farmer's market. Right next door to us was the flower booth. And we, you know, like, we're a family, all the farmers. And I miss it. My dad has recently sold the farm, so we don't do it anymore. But it is a childhood memory that I love and love going to still.
What was the best part of being there among the farmers?
I think just, like, the sense of, like I said, of the family, you know? Like, we all knew each other. We all helped each other. You know, like the comment earlier, you helped set up, you helped take down. Like, everyone, you know, was just there to help each other out. And that's the thing that I loved about it.
Sharon, thanks very much for the call. 801-355-TALK. When Mele and John, when you came into the studio, the first thing you did was compare the calluses on your hands and start talking about the soil and
apparently
about equipment and everything. Mele, farming as a family, talk about that.
Oh, you know, this is a family business that we're running here. It's my dad, and we're Tongan, and so the numbers are endless. We have huge turnout every Saturday, and we've gotten. That's how we get the tomatoes in the ground. That's how we get the weeding done. That's how everything happens. The family support in this thing has been absolutely incredible, and really we couldn't have done it without it and continue to. That's how we go on, is with this family. But I think that's the farming community in general. We've got this new piece of land, and we have the old timers come out, and it's so great. They're in their tractors, and they're debating, you can't plant the ambrosia next to the serendipity right now. You've got to wait. And, you know, I mean, it's great. It's great. The support that these farmers give each other. This is the way life needs to return. This is how we've got to get. And it's nice and refreshing to be part of an organization where you feel that, and in a business in general where that's the way it has to be.
I imagine that's part of what's kept you coming back, John Borski, for 17 years. This this community of farmers in the local area.
Hey, it's a really neat connection, and when you get together with a bunch of old farmers and you hear them start talking, you'll hear things that you've never heard before, and sometimes I go home and write them down because they're so fascinating.
Like
don't
what?
Plant your corn until you can see the snow horse up on the canyon up there in Layton, and all kinds of funny little stories like that. But, you know, the idea of community is so important. I couldn't get my farm work done if I didn't have the help of the Day family, who helps me, Mr. Mata down the street, who grows a few things, Dibble Farms up the street there in Layton. And if a tractor breaks down or something like that and they're in the middle of getting work done, there's a tractor that they can get from a neighbor, or a piece of equipment they can get for a neighbor. I broke down in front of a farm one time with an old truck. All my trucks are old. Because they're going to break down anyway eventually, right? Anyway, one of the old farmers, William Call, was out doing some work, and he saw my little truck break down with an axle that broke, and he came out and picked it up with his forklift, brought it in to his farm, and he and his boys had it fixed by the end of the day, and of course wouldn't charge you anything, and it's just a favor, and of course you're going to do one for them in return.
Absolutely.
If you feel the need.
John Borski with Borski Organic Farms in Kaysville. Also with us, Mele Tuaone from the Malolo Gardens in Salt Lake City, and Bob Farrington, the Salt Lake City Economic Development Director, former director of the Downtown Alliance, and a founder of the Downtown Farmers Market. We're talking about the 20th anniversary of the Farmers Market downtown, and if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. Bob Farrington, how has the market changed over the years? Kind of a tiny little gathering at the beginning. It's now blossomed. Are you getting the same clients? Are you getting different vendors? I mean, how has it changed?
Well, it's just the size and scope certainly has changed dramatically. But even maybe before mentioning that, I'm reminded by listening to John and Malaya that, you know, the real connection that the farmers make to the public, to their customers, and how they engage them and their personality and stories, that's what people were looking for. And, you know, so food is not a commodity. It's something that people put their heart and soul in, and when they purchase it, they have a conversation with the farmer, they can share that story, listen to how that beautiful radish got to the market despite all the obstacles of equipment breaking down, et cetera. You know, people are looking for that human connection. So even though the market has grown by leaps and bounds, that's what people are looking for, I think, from all the vendors, whether they're a farmer or a craft vendor or somebody that has some prepared food. There's a great story behind each of those vendors, and people are face-to-face with the owner of that business, and they get to become friends with them and engage with them. And there's not too many things in life that where you can do that outside your circle of friends and acquaintances that are community gathering spots. So that's the constant, even though the size and scope and scale of the market certainly has grown. I think that dimension has not changed.
Mm-hmm. Not all smooth sailing. I mean, there have been a few hiccups over the years.
Oh, sure.
The growth of the market has really made the park very crowded. Parking can be a huge issue. How has the city sort of dealt with that?
Well, you know, parking can be inconvenient, but I would generally say that when, you know, people want to do something and participate in it. It's a minor hassle. There's thousands of parking spaces around Pioneer Park. You might have to walk a block. You can't park right in front. In fact, we make sure that the farmers have the best spot along 3rd South where they can pull right up to the market. People like Gastronomy have turned over their parking garage on 4th West at no charge to the market patrons, as have the Hilton Garden Inn. So every business owner, operator of parking in the neighborhood has generally been very accommodating. So that's, I'd say, you know, a minor inconvenience. But if there wasn't a crowd, if there wasn't demand for it, there'd be no parking issue, and that would be the worst possible thing. So in some ways, that activity and the crowds that do come who are looking for this experience, I think people are certainly willing to put up with a little hassle.
What about dogs? It appears to be unusual to allow dogs to walk around a farmer's market.
Yeah, offline we were just visiting about that, and there was a little bit of, I guess, a kind of a method to the madness of allowing dogs to begin with, and that was to make sure that everyone was welcome down to the market initially, where we were trying to get more farmers and more customers, which would help support the farmers. And we weren't about to be too picky about who was coming and bringing their friends or pets. And the fact that it wasn't a park, the health department didn't have any rules or regulations against it, and seemed to be a customer base that was probably maybe the most loyal initial customers, or people who were able to combine a little outing with their pet and going to the farmer's market. But I know it's been one of the things that the Downtown Alliance in the last couple of years has surveyed customers and vendors extensively, kind of trying to find the best mix and match of that. In the new transformation of the park, there's an off-leash area, so people have a spot for their dogs. It'll probably be a continuing issue, but it seems like people are generally accommodating and willing to accept everyone and every living creature in the market, at least currently.
How would you improve the market? I mean, you've had 20 years to kind of examine this from an insider and an outsider. What do you think could be improved on what the market has become?
Well, the one opportunity that I think is still in front of us, and it's a complex and could somewhat costly enterprise, but I think the idea of a year-round market that is an extension of the farmer's market, but it's a little bit different in the sense that it would be not replacing in any way the farmer's market, but allow during the rest of the week farmers or specialty vendors to have a place that's nearby, and for the ones that are interested to have a kind of a shared opportunity under one roof to sell their products and goods. And
this proposal was for the depot, wasn't it?
Most currently it's being looked at the depot. There have been other sites, but the depot, the Rio Grande Depot, is the one that is being looked at most carefully. There have been a consultant that's been engaged for a number of years. I think eventually something will happen along those lines, and I think the public will embrace that the same way as the Saturday farmers market. And it's important to have those things, I think, directly linked and connected, you know, run by the same group in close proximity. So there's no question that one is an extension of the other.
Hmm. Mele, our time is short, but what are you hoping to get out of this first season at the Downtown Farmers Market?
Oh, we're hoping to get our name out, to get some good clientele based brought up. We're hoping to showcase our produce. We're going to be selling a tremendous amount of different varieties of everything. I'd just like people to see us, to get to know us. And then we'd also like to just be able to provide for the people. And then also, you know, we want to also donate a lot going along the lines. We're very interested in donating to the shelters, to Utah Food Bank, whatnot.
And John Borski, what advice would you give for a new grower like Mele? And what are the lessons that you've learned over the years that you've participated in the downtown farmers market?
The first advice I would give is to wear gloves. My fingers are cracking and falling apart, and get some good udder salve or something that will help keep them soft. But I think the main thing about farming is just being consistent at what you do and make sure that your quality is up for the farmer's market. Every now and then I see somebody walking around with a 3-foot zucchini at the farmer's market. I wonder, what the hell are they going to do with that thing? I guess they're going to go home and make bread or something out of it. But when I take my baby zucchinis and summer squash to the market, that's what makes it special, and seeing these specialty items and things that you can't get everywhere, and the quality of them being so exceptional that people just come to the market and they see what you've got and they get excited right there.
I appreciate that.
John Borski, he is the owner of Borski Organic Farms in Kaysville. He's been showing at and selling at the farmers market downtown for the past 17 years. John, thanks so much, and good luck this season.
Thank you.
Mele Tuaone, the owner of Malolo Gardens, an organic family farm. They've got a new storefront across from Pioneer Park, but they'll also have a booth at the downtown farmers market for the first time. Mele, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And Bob Farrington, a former director of the Downtown Alliance, currently the economic development director for Salt Lake City and a founder of the downtown farmers market. Bob, thanks for your time as well.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Downtown farmers market, of course, will open this Saturday. It will be open Saturday mornings through October, Tuesday evenings through from August to October in Pioneer Park, 300 West, 400 South in Salt Lake City. There's more information on our website, kcpw.org. Coming up next, we shift into high gear with a look at the fastest art exhibit around. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Car aficionados have long viewed their metal trophies as works of art. Now the rest of us can admire the artistry and the engineering of high-performance vehicles in a new exhibit at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts. Today on the program, we learn more about speed, which is rolling in some of the finest and fastest automobiles into town. And joining us by phone is Ken Gross. He has been an automotive journalist for 40 years, writing for publications such as Auto Week, Hot Magazine, and Motor Trend Classic. And he's also had articles featured in the New York Times magazine as well as USA Today. He's the former director of the Peterson Automotive Museum in Los Angeles, and he is the guest curator for the Utah Museum of Fine Arts at the University of Utah. The exhibit is Speed, the Art of the Performance Automobile. And Ken Gross joins us from Hamilton, Virginia. And Ken, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Jennifer. Pleased to be here.
Again, Speed, the Art of the Performance Automobile, is showing at the Museum of Fine Arts through September 16th. The museum will host lectures, a car-themed film series, an open hood event with Jay Leno in July, many more things going on at the museum going along with this exhibit. And there's more information at speedumfa.com. We'll also have links on our website, kcpw.org. But if you've got questions or comments about high-performance vehicles, do fancy cars get your motor running? Why do automobiles get you all revved up? If you've got questions about the artistic qualities of high-performance vehicles, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Ken Gross, 19 high-performance vehicles are on display in this exhibit at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts. They all have four wheels, but that's pretty much where the similarities end with most cars on the road today. What elevates these automobiles that are on display to the level of art in your mind?
Well, the idea of automobiles in a fine arts museum is really not new. In 1951 at MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, Arthur Dressler, the curator of architecture, presented 8 automobiles in a landmark display. And since then, there have been cars in the Phoenix Art Museum, wonderful exhibit called Curves of Steel, which I worked on, Allure of the Automobile at the High Museum of Art, and more recently in Portland. These cars are really, call them kinetic art. Dressler called them rolling hollow sculpture. It's not the first time, really, that items like furniture, for example, appear in fine art museums when they're special designs, when they're done for a purpose but beautifully executed. And that's what these cars are. Most of them are racing cars, and some are certainly high-performance cars for the road, and they're hand-built. They're made in very limited numbers, and in many cases, it's one of one, just like a painting or a piece of sculpture.
Hmm. Who are some of the engineers and designers who made this leap from functional vehicle to art? I mean, if they are artists, we recognize, you know, Van Gogh and others. I'm wondering who are the top designers, the engineers who have elevated cars to an art form?
Well, probably the best example in our exhibit is a 1929 Bugatti Grand Prix car. Ettore Bugatti was an engineer with more than the soul of an artist. He came from a family where his father Carlo designed Art Deco furniture at the turn of the 20th century, and Carlo's works are in many fine art museums around the world. Ettore's brother Rembrandt was a noted sculptor in bronze of animals, whose work today is worth a fortune. And Ettore and his son Jean designed cars, certainly with wonderful engineering elements, but cars that were just fascinating to look at. They were both intrigued with horses. The radiators are shaped like horseshoes. The shapes look kind of the way a T-shirt would on a really muscular guy. You can see the sinews. You can see the muscles beneath the skin. And Bugattis in their day, which was about 1910 to 1939, won more races than any other make. So those are, I think, some of the reasons that help qualify them. But stand back and look at a Bugatti. We have our Bugatti, along with the work of Harry Miller and Vittorio Jano, in a small gallery where we call it the Golden Age of the Racing Cars, 1930s. And each of these cars is a fabulous shape. They all were built to somewhat the same formula, but they're each different. And I just find them fascinating. I mean, the best thing to do when you can't do this in a gallery is stand there with a glass of wine and just take it all in.
Indeed. We're speaking with Ken Gross. He is the guest curator for the Utah Museum of Fine Arts' new exhibit, Speed, the Art of the Performance Automobile, that is showing now through September 16th. And you can join us if you've got questions or comments about car collecting, about the art of the automobile. Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Now, as you mentioned, many of these are racing cars, and one car actually doesn't even look like a car. I'm talking about the 1952 Beast III Streamliner. It doesn't appear to have lots of doors and windows. The wheels are hidden under these undulating curves of metal. It's a beautiful piece.
Well, actually, the curves of fiberglass. This car was built in 1952. The engineer was a man named Chet Herbert, who was confined to a wheelchair. And in the exhibit, we have a photograph of Chet on the cover of Hot Rod magazine, strapped into his wheelchair and welding the roll bar. They worked night and day to get this car ready for Bonneville. It was the first Bonneville car that we know that was designed in a wind tunnel. And Rod Chappell, who's now 90 years old and who designed it, built models first and then used the Caltech wind tunnel to perfect the design. If you look at this car from the side, you can't really see that in the photos, you'll notice a kind of an arching underneath. One of the challenges with making a car that goes really quickly and having it be perfectly aerodynamic is the more you make it like a wing, the more likely it might be to take off at high speed. And Chappell was one of the first to figure out how to use downforce to keep the faster the car went, air pressure would keep particularly the rear wheels steady and on the ground for great traction. And Art Chrisman, who drove this car to nearly 240 miles an hour in 1952, appeared at our opening night premiere. So we were very excited to have Art there, and he hadn't seen the car since it was restored, and he was just blown away. I mean, he tears came to his eyes, and he just shook his head and said, I can't believe it. So it was a wonderfully dramatic moment. This car is in the center of our exhibition, and right alongside it are two cars that really figure prominently in Utah racing history with Bonneville, because they were the Mormon Meteors 1 and 3. Rarely have they appeared together, and of course they were driven by Ab Jenkins, who was a Utahan and a great hero at Bonneville, a man who helped develop racing at the Salt Flats and who set endurance records, some of which still stand.
He also was the mayor of Salt Lake City.
Indeed.
Indeed.
In the 1940s.
How did he discover, he's often referred to as the father of Salt Flats racing. How did he discover that the Bonneville Salt Flats were just pristine and terrific places to go really fast?
Well, at the time, they were when he first discovered, if you will, I mean, the Salt Flats were there. He rode a motorcycle across in the very beginning and realized that even at high speeds, the surface was firm enough to allow him to do that. And as an early publicity stunt, he raced a train he was in a touring car, and managed to win. He started setting endurance records on the Salt because it was large enough and wide enough so that they could literally scribe a great circle and as quick as a car could possibly go for hour after hour, Jenkins would do it. And over the years and up through the 1930s, he was setting 12-hour records, 24-hour records, 36 and even 48-hour records, driving round and round on a sometimes 12.5-mile, sometimes 10-mile circle in cars that he helped construct himself. And I look back, as do other people, and think, how in the world, for hour after hour, could he do it? At one point, I think it was 1940, for 1 hour, he went around at 199 miles an hour in this enormous aircraft-engined car, which we have on display, the Mormon Meteor 3. And he did it by himself, no relief, they'd zip into the pit area, fill the car with fuel, he'd have a glass of milk or orange juice, and back he'd go again. So incredible feats, because he could do this for a day and even 2 days.
I want to play just a short clip from the film Boys of Bonneville, which kind of features some of Ab Jenkins' achievements. This is an archival clip of Ab driving the Mormon Meteor 3. Let's take a listen, and then we'll get your thoughts on that.
The timer looks at his watch, says, "We're ready if you are." "All right, I'm ready to go."
And before you can say a 10-letter word, Ab is underway again. There is now a tremendous national interest in everything that Ab Jenkins does. Day and night he roars on. How does this man do it? What nerves and stamina he must have.
I love that clip. What nerves and stamina he must have. It is, a physical feat for him to physically be able to do that. But the car was a machine, is a machine. And you say many of the records still stand today.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. Part of that might be that several of his records were broken a few years ago, and it took a team of people to do it. He drove with occasional relief from some Indianapolis drivers at the time, where they'd drive for a few minutes, maybe 10 or 15 or so. And he, to a man, and I'm sorry, they were all men, each of these guys would say, "I don't know how he does it, how he can do this for hour after hour, you know, half day after half day." And I can't imagine it either. I mean, if you sit in the cockpit of one of these cars, you know, it's somewhat claustrophobic. The motor is huge and making an awful lot of noise. The Salt, and to some degree, in the daytime, at least there are some little landmarks that you could look at, the mountains and so forth. At night, most of that disappears. So it really was an extraordinary record. He attributed his success to his strong Mormon faith, the fact that he didn't drink or smoke, and who can argue with that?
Speaking with Ken Gross, the guest curator of the new exhibit at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts at the University of Utah. It's called Speed, the Art of the Performance Automobile, and it's now showing through September 16th. Ken Gross, I mean, you can't really hear it in that clip, but what I did hear was a roar. It sounded like a rocket. What makes the sound of a race car unique?
Well, at Bonneville in particular, you hear cars almost the way you never hear them on a racetrack, where speeds change. At Bonneville, you get up to speed and you just go. So you're turning the highest number of revolutions that an engine can. So once it's built up to that level, you're hearing the engine as loud as it can be, developing as much power as it can. So it's pretty exciting. One of the things, too, when you are at Bonneville, and many of your listeners have probably been there, and I've been there several times, once a car shuts off in the traps, you know, you hear this enormous noise, and then suddenly there's this utter silence. And it's kind of breathtaking when it happens. Mm.
In the exhibit, you have not only race cars, but you've also got Steve McQueen's Jag. You've got a Shelby Cobra, just one of six that were made. But I understand that your favorite of the 19 being shown is the 1911 Mercer. What makes this car so special to you?
Well, Mercer was a sports car before the term was invented. Lightweight, nimble, agile. Developed in Trenton, New Jersey by a guy named Finley Robinson Porter. When I was the director of the Peterson Museum, we purchased a Mercer race about. I was thrilled to do it. It cost nearly $1 million at the time, and they're worth a lot more now. And there was something about getting in a century-old car that would shift and steer and turn like a nimble modern car that just blew me away. I'd heard Mercers were good. I couldn't believe how good they were. Now, the brakes are another story. There's two sets of brakes. They're both on the rear wheels. You do your best with the foot pedal, but really the hand brake is what helps you stop the car. But the idea with a Mercer is go quick and off the showroom floor. A Mercer was a car that you could take to a race in 1910, 11, 12, and have a very good likelihood of winning. And that's, you know, you try to do that with a car today, and you really can't. It's still a car that'll do 100 miles an hour. And I've done over 80 in one, and with the wind whistling, you feel like you're going even quicker.
Now, there are 19 vehicles on display at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts. What's a collection like this worth?
I can't really tell you each individual number, but the aggregate of all these cars, now all 19, is well over $100 million.
Wow. I imagine insurance is an issue for a curator like you.
Well, insurance is different for the for exhibits. There are a couple of firms that specialize in insuring cars like this. In the case of the museum, the University of Utah is handling that issue, and you know they know what the cars are worth. And certainly, there are art objets that are worth in that range. But I think it's all under control, and we've got a wonderful security group out there, so I'm confident nothing will happen.
I understand that of the 19 cars, a fair number of them are from the private collections of prominent Utahns here. John Price, the former ambassador, also Larry H. Miller's family has contributed to this exhibit.
Right. John Price was the major impetus for the exhibit, and we have 11 of his cars, and we're very happy to do that. I hadn't met John before the started working on this exhibit, came out, looked at his collection, and was really impressed with what he had. And part of the assignment really was to develop an exhibit that perhaps took the best of John's collection and went even further. We've divided it up into four sections. We have our pre-war cars, speeding into the century, I've called those. We have, as I mentioned, the golden age of the American racing car. We've got Bonneville, crucible of speed, with seven fabulous cars in our center gallery. And then we end with speed and performance for the road. You mentioned Steve McQueen's Jaguar, which is one of only 16 built. My experience with that car was that having been able to purchase it for the Peterson Museum with Bob Peterson, so I'm very familiar with it, got to drive it a few times. We also have a Ferrari, a one-of-a-kind 375 MM that was owned by Roberto Rossellini and Ingrid Bergman, one of the most glamorous couples of the 50s. It's a 1954 Ferrari. The body design is totally unique, and it's absolutely stunning. You see it under the lights, and it looks as though it's crouching and ready to spring like a lion. I know visitors will enjoy seeing it.
just a few seconds left, but if people are going to the museum, what's the not-miss object in your mind?
Well, seeing the two Mormon meteors together is very special. They've only appeared, they were built in slightly different eras. They've only appeared together a few occasions. They've never been in the museum together, and I think, to me, that's really stunning. And I also, like you, I really like the Beast 3, the story behind it, and it's on a pedestal like a giant ruby in the center of the gallery. Mm. It's special.
Beautiful stuff. Ken Gross, thanks so much for your time. He is the guest curator for the Utah Museum of Fine Arts exhibit, Speed, the Art of the Performance Automobile, which is showing now through September 16th. Ken, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Jennifer. All the best.
City Views is a production of KCPW News in Salt Lake City. Thanks to Lauren Hendrickson. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Tomorrow, the ongoing debate over dogs and when and where they should be leashed. Join us for that tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.